Well, Professor Fletcher, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm glad that you could be with us on the show.
Well, thank you.
I think that we understand why the Getz case seized the public imagination the way it did. It seems pretty clear that a lot of people looked at Bernard Getz and in a way they saw themselves as a victim or as someone who was afraid of being a victim. And, you know, they looked at him and saw that he had done something that in their minds they had probably done countless times. So, you know, you can see why it is that it caught the public imagination. From a legal point of view, why is the case significant, or is it important for the law?
Well, I do think that the case captured our imagination for reasons that are both good and bad. To take the bad reasons first, there's simply a great deal of violence and excitement and thrill involved in a spontaneous outburst of violence, particularly when the outburst of violence is colored by an image of good triumphing over evil. So this was a form of violence on the subway that people obviously loved. It appealed to a base side of our general interest in blood and gore. On the other hand, I think that the case appealed to a more noble instinct, and that is that the more people thought about the case, the more they looked into the facts, the more the media got straight about how subtle and complicated the factual situation was, the more people realized, the more all of us realized, that this was really a moral cliffhanger. It became a case of tremendous dramatic potential. Mm-hmm. The reason is that we could no longer tell exactly what was right and what was wrong, whether Getz acted reasonably in self-defense or not. It became a case that tested our moral judgment. And I think that's the reason in the end why it still fascinates us.
Hmm. Do you think that the media did a bad job in covering this case?
I wouldn't say that the media did a worse job than it does in other situations. I think that there are a couple of dramatic examples of willful misreporting. One of them is the story about the sharpened screwdrivers, which the New York media, including the New York Times, picked up very early in the week after the shooting. There was absolutely no basis in fact for the story that the screwdrivers carried by the four young black men were sharpened. But once it was, once it appeared, I think the first place it appeared was Sidney Schoenberg's column in the New York Times, everyone picked it up. Now, some of these columns said that the police reported it. I don't know whether that's simply a journalistic conceit or whether it really is true that some police officer told some reporter that the screwdrivers were sharpened. But no one bothered to check until Jimmy Breslin looked into it, and then he blew the whistle on the story of the sharpened screwdrivers. But still, you'll find lots of people who believe that they must have been sharpened. After all, these kids were hoodlums, and what would they be carrying if they weren't sharpened screwdrivers? It's that kind of approach to the case, that is, the desire to oversimplify it, to see it as a case of good versus bad, of a middle-class, respectable citizen squaring off against four black hoodlums, that sometimes drives the press to misreporting the facts.
Mm-hmm. I think that in the wake of the case, and especially of the decision in which he was found guilty only of illegally carrying that loaded gun, there was a great deal of concern that it would set a precedent in people's minds, and that we would see a lot of incidents like it, and we didn't.
Well, that's a very good point, Dave. It's true. And I think that's one of the complicated aspects of saying that this case captured the public imagination. It did not generate copycat incidents. It's difficult to say that the public admired Oswald, even though the shooting of Kennedy generated imitations and other tragic assassinations. It may be that when someone acts correctly in the public mind and captures the public fantasy by doing what the public thinks is right, then people are not so inclined to imitate. Frankly, I don't know why Oswald had imitators but Getz did not. I mean, that's one of these unresolved mysteries about the case that keeps me interested, even though I finished the book and I'm trying to explain the book. I still think there are unanswered questions.
Mm-hmm. It seems that that one of the interesting things about the case was the fact that that Bernard Goetz felt so strongly that that he was right, and that he did not, he wanted people to believe that he had been in his right mind, that this was a rational choice that he had made. In fact, he got rid of his first attorney because apparently he thought this man was going to claim that was going to take an insanity defense,
right?
And yet there's something, you know, even though he tried to paint himself as being reasonable, there was something a little bit disturbing about him, and I would think that anybody who saw the tape of his statement that he gave after after going public would think that, you know, might have questions in their own mind about his rationality.
Well, that's a very interesting aspect of the trial that you bring out. It would have been fairly easy for Goetz to defend himself on grounds of mental distress. It would have been a relevant fact on the side of the defense, either diminished responsibility, perhaps, or insanity at the extreme. But Goetz was very concerned and deeply committed to avoiding any argument that would have cast aspersion upon his character. He wanted to be tried on the question of right or wrong, and I respect him very much for that. I think this is a very positive side of his personality. Of course, he thinks he did the right thing. A lot of us might think that he did the wrong thing, but in a way that's not as important as his commitment to debating the morality both of the shooting and of his carrying the unloaded gun in public, the loaded gun in public. So I think that that really is it is a curious side of the case, because usually you'll find criminal defendants trying to get off on whatever argument will work. But here we have a case of a man who wanted to be tried on the moral level, and that is he deserves applause for that.
Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps we ought to talk a little bit about what the law says about self-defense and how we try to determine whether, in fact, in a case like this, one is right. I'm not even sure. I'm hesitant to say that's the right word to use. Whether the law perhaps would say one is justified in using a deadly force against another person.
Why do you hesitate at the word right?
just because I think perhaps, as you said before, that in the case like this, the questions of what's right and what's wrong are not clear. And perhaps in my own mind, after I was finished reading the book, in fact, I think perhaps I felt informed, and yet I still wasn't quite sure how I felt about it.
Yes, indeed. Well, that only requires us to think more deeply about the problem, mm-hmm. and to try to get at the issues. But surely there must be a right or wrong in the matter, and that's exactly what drives us to think about it. We can't take refuge in external legal rules as though they were somehow important apart from the question of right and wrong. Legal rules get their force and their vitality from being responsive to important moral principles. If they're not responsive to those principles, then they are the kinds of technicalities that Bernhard Goetz railed against. This is partly the sense in which the law was on trial in this case, as my subtitle indicates, that the question was whether the rules of law that would come to bear in this case would be morally responsive, or would they be some bureaucratic artifact imposed on us by an external authority that had no sense whatsoever of right and wrong. So let's be specific about these principles. Mm-hmm. One basic question that comes up in the Goetz case, as well as in the wife battering disputes, is whether the individual has shot either too soon or too late relative to the pending attack. If the individual defends himself and resorts to force too soon, then he will be accused of a preemptive attack, that is, anticipating an attack and responding before the attack has ripened to the point of imminent danger. On the other hand, if he waits too long, and if he waits until the act is over, until there is no longer an impending threat against him, then the use of force will be characterized as retaliation, as vengeance, rather than as self-defense. So the major problem then at the first level of discussion is, can we say that the use of force came neither too soon nor too late? Now, in the Goetz case, the major problem was whether Goetz should have waited longer relative to the implicit threat coming from Troy Canty. After all, Troy Canty approached him and said, give me $5. Now, Goetz thought that he had verification, as he called it, that a mugging was underway simply because he asked Canty to repeat himself, and Canty said, give me $5 a second time. Now, was that enough to induce us to believe that a mugging was imminent? What would have happened if Goetz had said, buddy, I wish I had $5, and he would have walked to the other side of the car? No one knows, right? No one knows exactly what would have happened. I personally have a great deal of difficulty concluding that the four young men were bent on mugging Goetz at that moment. On the other hand, I think that, this is a controversial question. We can talk about it sooner. So this is the problem of responding too soon. Now, in the case of Daryl Cabey, who was the fourth young man shot, there's an argument that Goetz responded too late. That is, the confession that Goetz gave in New Hampshire says that after the fourth shot, he paused. He looked over at Daryl Cabey and saw that he was sitting motionless, passively, in the subway seat, and he walked over to him and said, you look all right, here's another, and shot him point blank. Now, if that really were true, then it would seem that Goetz shot Daryl Cabey too late relative to the threat of attack against Goetz, because indeed at that point, Daryl Cabey was not a threat to anyone. The three other young men had been immobilized. Daryl Cabey was sitting there, no sign of a weapon, no sign of danger coming from him, no sign of aggressive intentions. At that point, it would seem that the danger against Goetz had already passed, and it would not have been legitimate self-defense to shoot Daryl Cabey in that way. Now, the major dispute at the trial was whether, in fact, it happened that way. Did Goetz really do that, or did he empty his gun, as the defense said, in rapid succession, without a pause, and without actually going over to Daryl Cabey and uttering those fateful words?
Do you? I wonder if you have any feeling for this matter. If in fact he had not done that, as he said he did in his statement, why would he have said that?
Well, of course, this is one of the interesting problems in my study of the jury deliberations, and I think one of the most fascinating aspects of writing this book was indeed getting inside the jury's mind in a way that, frankly, I've never seen elsewhere in the literature on crime and justice. The jury, in any deliberation of this sort, the jury always confronts anomalies, particular factual problems that don't square with their general hypothesis of what happened. So if they were to accept the confession, then the major anomaly would have been, yes, but what about the fact that eight witnesses said that they did not hear a pause between the fourth and the fifth shots, right? That would have been an anomaly. It wouldn't have fit their hypothesis that the confession was accurate on the Daryl Cabey issue. On the other hand, if they accepted the defense's theory that Goetz didn't really walk over and say those words and then shoot point blank, then we have your question, namely, why does Goetz say this in the confession? And the argument that many of the jurors used to explain that to themselves was that people fantasize aggressive behavior after an incident that goes beyond, in fact, what they did. I mean, we hear this story all the time, that people, after a criminal incident, after being mugged or witnessing someone else being mugged, are likely to say to themselves, God, I would have killed that person. I wanted to kill that person. That is, that they have a sense of aggression toward the person who has hurt them or a loved one that goes and be, in fact, that is a form of fantasy. Now, I'm not saying whether this is really true. But this was the argument that the jurors used to themselves. And one of the jurors, a woman whom I interviewed, reported her own incident of rage after witnessing her mother being mugged. And that helped convince the jurors that maybe Goetz was engaged in a rage-induced fantasy about what he really wanted to do to Daryl Cabey, but which he didn't do.
I think that suggests something interesting about juries, and that is that, and I think you pointed out, that, one, as an attorney, you can marshal all the evidence, you can call in experts and get your ballistics experts in there to talk about trajectories of bullets and what may or may not have happened, and yet when it all comes down to the final deliberations and the jury is in there in the jury room, what will probably be most important to them is their own, maybe perhaps their own experience, their own common sense, their own thoughts about human nature, that is what they will use perhaps more than anything else to make their decision.
Well, that's true to a certain extent, but I think that it's also very important to keep in mind that the jury in a politically charged case like the Goetz case is deeply afraid, this jury was deeply afraid of being held accountable politically for the result. They didn't want people afterwards to say, well, you people relied upon your own political and moral judgment instead of the legal instructions from the judge. They compulsively paid attention to the instructions from the judge. They wanted, in effect, to hide behind the legal instructions so that they did not personally feel any responsibility for the outcome. Now, it's true that inevitably their experience comes into play, but at the conscious level, they do an incredibly intensive job of working with the materials they're supposed to work with and fulfilling their oath as they have sworn to do. They are, I was quite impressed, really, by the commitment of the jury to do its job properly.
You in the section of the book where you talk about the process of jury selection, one of the things that you see is how many of these jurors themselves were victims of crime. And
yes, that's quite amusing, isn't it? At one point, Justice Crane had to change the question around. At first, he said, now, who's been a victim of crime? And so many people raised their hands that he turned around and said, now, who hasn't been a victim of crime? That's true. This was a widespread problem.
How important do you think that the experience of the jurors in that respect, I mean, how significant do you think that was in their deliberations and their arriving at a decision, or was that really not important at all?
Well, that's very difficult to say. I mean, these people were not the direct victims of violent crime. They might have been the victim of a burglary, or in the case of the woman I was just describing, her mother was mugged. These people were not the direct victims of crime. Now, I think that people who have never been victims sometimes have greater fears of crime than people who have been victims but not been hurt, because the individuals who have been victims but have survived have seen, perhaps, that this is not necessarily the end of the world. Whereas I think individuals who, we all live in a tremendous fear of crime. It's one of the facts of life in America, one of the fascinating facts of life. That we probably fear crime more than we fear nuclear attack. And I think that this does play on people's anxieties to a tremendous extent. Whether it makes a difference whether one has been the victim of a nonviolent crime is very difficult for me to say. I think the victims of violent crime are surely deeply scarred by the experience and are doubly apprehensive of a repetition.
We talked a little bit earlier about the some of the questions one must ask in looking at self-defense, and you said that one of the issues involved the timing of the response, and that is one must not seem to make a preemptive strike. One must also not strike too late. That is, I guess you cannot shoot someone if they just look like they might mug you. Neither can you shoot someone after they've mugged you and they're running away. Something else that's also important that you talk about is proportionality. And that is, one might ask, when Goetz was approached by this man and said, give me $5. And Goetz knew that he had a gun in a holster in his belt. He could have done a number of things. He could have said, as you suggest, you know, well, I don't have $5, and walk away. He could have done a number of things. He could have shown them the gun. He could have drawn the gun. One must have to ask, did he actually have to fire the gun and shoot these assailants, alleged assailants, as he did?
Well, yes, and that is a very good question. The issue of proportionality has to be distinguished from a closely related question of whether the shooting was necessary under the circumstances. And many of these questions arise under both rubrics, in both contexts. The first question is, would a lesser means have been sufficient, that is, merely pulling the gun and displaying it? Would that have been sufficient to deter the attack? Now, it might have been, but I think most of the jurors were inclined to think that this would be too dangerous to Goetz himself in view of the closed circumstances there. If they were on the street or in an open area, then I think that pulling of the gun would have been legitimately required, and perhaps even firing a warning shot would have been expected, but under the circumstances that would have been too dangerous to the other passengers on the train. On the assumption that a particular means, like shooting, is necessary, that no lesser means will do, then the question of proportionality is whether the individual must forego his right of self-defense altogether simply because the interest that he is trying to protect is too insignificant compared to the danger and the harm that's going to be inflicted upon the aggressor. We see this debate frequently in the context of burglary, and I think that there's been probably more legal change and movement in the area of burglary than in any other. And the question there is whether if the homeowner is on the premises and someone breaks in, but the homeowner has no basis to fear for his life, let's say for some reason the burglar makes it clear that he's there for business only and he's only going to steal and make his way out, can the homeowner nonetheless use deadly force to protect his premises? That is, Colorado enacted a new law, California enacted a new law that gives the homeowner more rights under those circumstances, and it's basically a right to protect the security of their home and the dignity of their home against an intruder without clear evidence of a personal risk to the homeowner himself. Sometimes the law is formulated as a presumption of danger that arises merely from the break-in, but the homeowner doesn't have to prove that he was personally in danger. Now, that I think is an issue of proportionality, because the question is whether the sanctity of the home is as important or is sufficiently important to justify killing the burglar. At one time in the 60s, the general tendency was to think, no, that is not enough. You need a threat of personal violence in order to be able to justify killing the burglar. I think it is safe to say that the tendency today is toward a looser standard of proportionality, namely recognizing the right of self-defense, even to protect relatively less significant interests, we now have a willingness to sacrifice the lives of aggressors and attempting aggressors simply to protect various forms of property interest.
Hmm. Well, do you think that the loosening of the standard of proportionality in the case of defense of the home has extended to our thinking about individuals and their defense of their persons?
Well, that's intriguing, because the home is the place where most people begin their thinking about self-defense. That is, the primary example is the notion of the home as the castle, the absolute right to expel intruders. And the problem frequently is, do we metaphorically take our home with us, and that is our private space with us, when we move into the public arena? So that one way to look at the Goetz problem is that, in fact, he did have a right to ride on that subway without being harassed, without even being put in risk, without being approached, without having money demanded of him. Now, if you look at it that way and you say that he has a right to a private space about him, then that obviously would justify his expelling the intruders who aggressed against him merely by trying to get money from him. So the whole problem can be redefined not as an attempted assault or an attempted robbery, but merely as aggression against his private space. There's no doubt that Barry Slotnick appealed to metaphors of that sort in presenting the case. It is one of the strands of self-defense that ran through the case. And I find in talking to large numbers of people about this case that many people seem to think instinctively that Goetz had a protected aura about him that was violated as soon as Troy Canty asked for the money.
Mm-hmm. Well, I talked a little bit at the beginning about the outcome of the case, and I'm sure that people will recall it, the fact that Bernard Goetz was charged with a number of things. He was charged with carrying a loaded gun in public without a permit. He was also charged with various things, endangerment of the other passengers there. He was charged, I believe, also with assault. He was charged with attempted murder. The jury found him not guilty of all of those things and found him guilty only of the charge of carrying the gun without the permit. Do you, and I wonder if you think that that was a good decision.
That's putting me on the spot. I think it was a reasonable decision. I think it was a fair decision. I think that Goetz definitely got a fair trial, and I think that the prosecution side was adequately heard and fairly considered. I think that my own inclination in looking at the evidence would have been to be slightly harder on Goetz on the self-defense issue. That is, I probably would have voted for a conviction on assault against Darrell Cabey, the last of the four. I was more inclined to believe the confession than the jury was. But on the other hand, to show you how complicated the situation is, I would have been sympathetic to an argument that the defense did not raise on the issue of carrying the loaded gun without a permit. I think there were arguments that could have been raised, that could have been advanced in order to defeat that charge, and I frankly would have been sympathetic to those arguments. In Illinois, you have the same statutory provision that New York has, namely a provision of necessity, of lesser evils, of acting to avoid the greater danger. And arguably, Bernard Goetz was acting on the basis of personal necessity in carrying that gun under those circumstances. But this was not an argument that the defense raised at all, which, of course, is quite amazing.
Let me ask you one more question, and then I have a caller here, and I would like to bring them into our discussion and other folks who are listening, too. Bernard Goetz has yet to serve his sentence. It was appealed, interestingly enough, by both the prosecution and the defense. What do you think is going to happen with that, and when will he actually begin to serve some kind of sentence?
There is an appeal now, just recently recognized, to the Court of Appeals, namely the High Court in New York. That appeal will be heard in October. They will announce their decision in November. And my prediction is that Goetz will then be sentenced to 1 year in jail, which means that he'll surrender immediately and go to jail in November. That's almost 4 years after the shooting. And that he will serve a minimum of 2 months, actually, in jail, and then he would be able to be released on parole. But I would say that that scenario is at least 90% likely.
Mm-hmm.
The appellate maneuvering going on is largely a matter of ritual and cleaning up some of the loose ends in the case, that's all.
Hmm. Also, Goetz is being sued by Darrell Cabey for a civil suit, I believe, for $50 million.
That's right.
He was, one of the shots severed his spinal cord, and he was paralyzed as a result. What do you think might be the outcome of that case?
Well, one thing that is significant is that in the civil case, Goetz has a less favorable position on the question of self-defense than he had in the criminal case. That is, the prosecution in a criminal case must disprove self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt. In the civil case, the defendant must prove self-defense by a preponderance of the evidence. That means that even though Goetz was acquitted because the jury had a reasonable doubt about self-defense, another jury in the civil case might not accept Goetz's argument that he acted in self-defense. And frankly, I think that there is a very, very good chance that Goetz will be held liable in the civil case.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk with this caller that we have. And also, I'd like to encourage other people listening. And we have about 15 minutes left in the program. If you would like to be a participant, you have some thoughts to offer or a question, all you need to do is call us in Champaign-Urbana. The number is 333-9455. Toll free in Illinois, 800-222-9455. And here's someone on our toll free line. Hello.
Yeah, how you doing, David?
Good.
You answered about three quarters of my question, the last couple of comments. I was wondering what what happened with Goetz and now KB, he's paralyzed. How about the other three people that were involved? What's happened to them?
One of them, Troy Candy, the man who initiated the entire confrontation, negotiated his way into a drug rehabilitation program. Mm-hmm. Has detoxified himself. He entered a course on how to become a short order cook, which I think he has completed, and so far as I know, he's gone straight.
Mm-hmm.
The other two, Barry Allen and James Ramsura, are in jail. Barry Allen on the basis of a charge that occurred before the shooting, and James Ramsura on the basis of this notorious rape that occurred 5 months after the shooting.
Yeah, so maybe Goetz wasn't far off, huh?
Well, there's a big difference between being... that's a very complicated...
I'm just saying,
First of all, Goetz had no basis himself for knowing. What could you possibly mean he wasn't far off?
Well, I'm just saying, KB probably would have been in jail as well. I mean, good chances are he would have been if he hadn't have been shot. But
it's possible.
Yeah, very possible.
But not on the basis of what happened in the subway car.
Yeah.
None of these four was prosecuted for what happened in the subway car.
Oh, right. But that's the whole problem with the system, I think that I think we're going to have to start to examine previous records and everything else and convict on that basis. I think we're going to have to start to look at these things.
A lot depends on whether you believe in the presumption of innocence and whether individuals are entitled to be tried on the basis of what they have done on the particular occasion.
Mm-hmm.
It would be a very...
It just shows what type individuals they were. I mean,
we don't know what type. That doesn't show anything whatsoever about what type of individuals they were.
In my opinion, it does.
Well, most people are inclined to believe that because most people want to believe that poor black kids from the Bronx
are likely to be
hoodlums.
Bronx.
Then what does it show?
Huh?
What does it show?
Well, it just shows that these individuals were bad people. Let's face it.
How was Goetz supposed to have known that they were bad people?
Well, it's proven that they attacked him. They went after him.
No, that's not proven that they attacked him. I think that's precisely the debate.
Why has he been exonerated from it, then?
I'm sorry?
Why has he been exonerated? The only thing he's convicted of is carrying a gun.
Now, one thing that's very important to understand is that Goetz would be convicted if the jury had a reasonable doubt about whether he acted in self-defense. That doesn't mean that they believed that he acted in self-defense. It means that the prosecution didn't convince them of the contrary. As I just said a second ago, that when the civil suit comes up, it'll be much more difficult for Goetz to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that he acted in self-defense.
What do you suppose he'll do?
That he'll do in the civil case?
Yeah.
Well, he won't. I mean, it'll be the same trial, basically, but he has a...
I'm just saying, what's it going to prove? If he wins, KB wins, he'll probably file bankruptcy, and that'll be the end of it.
Well, no one knows how much money Goetz has. That's one of the problems here. This is Goetz's family has a considerable amount of money.
Oh,
and,
Goetz's family may have the money, but he.
Well,
I'm sure that he doesn't. You know,
we don't know.
He's just working stiff like everybody else.
Well, we don't know.
Yeah.
About that, as a matter of fact, and.
But anyhow, no, that's all I wanted to get across to the whoever's listening out there. You know that.
Well, I don't think that this is. I think that the more interesting question here in the case is not the repetition of something that everyone believes, namely that these kids were no good punks, but the attempt to see the moral complexity of the case. And it wouldn't be very interesting to us. We wouldn't remember it. We wouldn't be debating it. We wouldn't be here talking today unless the case were a morally complex case. We would just have forgotten that it would be another shooting on the subway. Who would care? It would be another statistic. But the case is a great cultural monument, largely because it is so difficult to know. And it, even though these kids did have questionable backgrounds, there was no way for Goetz to know that. And under the law of self-defense and under the principles, the moral principles of self-defense, he has to know whether he's in danger in order for those factors of danger to be relevant. He just can't shoot and then find out later that it was a bunch of criminals who were attacking him.
Yeah.
The same reason that the screwdrivers were not relevant to his claim of self-defense. The screwdrivers stayed in those pockets. They never came out of the pockets. And if that's the case, then they are irrelevant to the claim of self-defense. They don't show that the kids were aggressing. They were there, and they were basically not significant.
I have several other callers. Let's
sure.
talk with some other people here. Line
right.
number one, next. Hello.
Hi, I was just calling about in response to the last caller's logic. And if that's the case, then I think maybe we should just arrest or go ahead and try and kill all the bankers in America.
Why is that?
Well, for one, they charge, you know, outrageous interest rates, and they're wrecking a lot of lives in that sense. But, I mean, here's these kids that are kind of in a financial prison of sorts, and they're just, I mean, look at the ghettos. They're just a product of economic depravity, and I don't really think that's, you know, fair.
Well, I think that it's interesting that you make this point because this is an aspect of the case that we don't hear as often as we should. It's the kind of argument that we were more likely to hear in the 60s, but
yeah.
that has basically been forgotten in the 80s, and
yeah.
I have some reflections on that in the book. I think that's one of the tragic aspects of this case is that we have forgotten how miserable the lives and the backgrounds of these four young men were. I think
yeah.
the tendency today is simply to respond with rage rather than with
sure,
some understanding.
Nobody's responding with rage to all the people that are killing the little kids in Nicaragua. I mean, it's like a total politic game. They don't really care who's, I mean, they care who's getting killed, not that they are getting killed.
That's right. I think that's right. I think that when we feel that we ourselves are threatened, then we're more likely to respond with rage. And it's a fairly primitive response, I have to agree with you.
Let me jump in again. I hope the caller will forgive me if I go on to somebody else here. We'll go next to line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Well, if somebody's in California, you know, and they're walking down the street and they're surrounded by a gang, you know, and even if they don't have knives out and everything like that, do they have a right to say, look, I'm in trouble, maybe I should do something, you know? Even if there's no knife out, but they're crowding around you and, you know, taunting you. You know, it seems to me that that's pretty much, you know, you go with self-preservation there.
Well, I'm not sure of the picture that you have in mind here. You have a case in which
well, when
someone
I was
is totally surrounded,
in,
he has no place to go.
Uh-huh.
Right?
And then you got to do something like...
Right. Well, I think that, you see, I mean, I think that it's true, but we have to be clear about whether Goetz wasn't surrounded.
Uh-huh.
One person walked over to him. There was possibly another person standing midway
uh-huh.
in the subway car.
Yeah,
if he had been surrounded, that uh-huh. might have been a different story.
Uh-huh.
If he would have tried to walk away and he couldn't have,
uh-huh.
that would have been pretty clear evidence. Let's suppose that he tried to walk to the other side of the car and he was pushed.
Uh-huh.
That would have been, then it would have been no, there would have been no dispute.
Uh-huh.
But it's very difficult to think of Getz as the lone cowboy surrounded by the Indians.
Uh-huh.
Not that quite. It's not that obvious.
Well, I think maybe that he thought that you know, things were going to happen in danger and self-preservation and everything like that. Maybe when he was there, that the reactions and the looks and the stares, you know, all added up to he was in trouble.
Well, that's right. I think there's no doubt about it.
You know,
his point of view, he concluded that he was in trouble.
Uh-huh.
That's absolutely clear. And I think one of the problems in the law of self-defense and in the morality of self-defense that we haven't talked about is whether your own beliefs are sufficient to justify your response,
right,
or whether you have to act as a reasonable person would under the circumstances.
Right.
And there was a lot of argument about that in the Getz case. It took them over a year to straighten out that point.
Uh-huh.
And they finally concluded, the courts have finally concluded that your personal belief is not enough. You've got to act according to the standard of a reasonable person under the circumstances.
And I don't care, you know, the background of a person that's about ready to mug somebody. You know, you can say, well, they rode up and they were poor and everything like that. You're still going to get mugged. You know?
Absolutely, I agree. There's not, the back personal background of these people has nothing to do whatsoever with whether or not you have a right to self-defense.
That's right.
Oh, that's a very interesting point. I mean, it's exactly the same threat, and the whether there's any compassion for these people, it only bears upon whether on their punishment for what they're doing and how they should be responded to. It has nothing to do whatsoever with the right of self-defense. That's a very interesting point.
Let's talk to someone else here on our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, my question is, the lad who was crippled in this affair, would he have any action against the subway system in addition to Getz as far as reclaiming monies?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think that in order to sue the subway system, he would have to show that the system of police protection on the subway was negligent for not protecting him against Bernhard Getz, that is, for not having a police officer in the car at the time. I think that would be almost impossible to show under these circumstances. I mean, no one has gone so far as to say you have to have a cop on every car. There was a subway guard a few cars away who came on the scene immediately after the shooting. But that's a good, interesting question. I think that there are more and more suits against those people who are supposed to protect us against danger.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We're almost out of time, but let's get one more person here, line number one again. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Well, I am bringing up a subject that has been touched on today, I think. I'm going to point out something that I read in the June 29th, 1987 issue of Time magazine. It was an article about this incident. And the final paragraph points out an incident that happened in April of 1980 where a black man was riding a subway in Brooklyn and a couple of white youths were, I'll say, accosting him by uttering racial insults. This black man took out an unlicensed gun and shot one of those 17-year-olds dead. He did not confess. He did not turn himself in. 6 years later, police did track him down. A grand jury refused to indict him, and that was the end of it. I don't think that ever made the papers in this part of the country, and I'm not sure it made headlines anyplace. And I think it was very quickly forgotten. And I think there are many similarities there, and I really think there are some people trying to use this case to their own ends. And I think there are a lot of gun control people who are trying to use Getz as an example to say, and I must say I believe in handgun control, but I think, you know, it may be cutting off our nose to spite our face to pick out this one guy who's not terribly attractive and use him to say, see, if you go out carrying a gun and you do something, you are going to suffer. And I think many people, all races, all socioeconomic groups, do identify with a person who is accosted in public. We would all like to feel that we can walk out into the public area and be left alone if we want to be left alone. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, just would kind of like to hear some comments on this. And maybe others would like to check out this particular issue of Time Magazine.
Yes. Well, I mean, there are many, many cases in which that have arisen in which the colors are transposed. I mean, I think usually the, I mean, we have the Carl Rowan incident in Washington just recently in which a black man shot at and injured a white youth in the hands. So it's not that but usually these incidents are brought out in order to show that there wasn't a racist motive behind the Getz case. You seem to have a different point in mind, and I think that the my comment to that is that I don't think anyone selected or in this case or is using this case, the mass appeal of the case, the mass response by everyone, every place, the fact that you know so much about it yourself, indicates how powerful this case is in the public imagination. Your own knowledge of this is the best testimony to that. And it's because the case is so important that I decided to write this book, because I think the case is a vehicle for enabling people to enter into to deeper questions of the law and to learn about the subtleties behind the case that were never brought out in the media, that of course are not appropriate for the media, but which are appropriate for book-length treatment.
I'm going to have to jump in and end there. Very pleased that you could be with us. It's quite an interesting book.
Well, thank you very much.
And again, if you're interested in reading more about the case, you should look for A Crime of Self-Defense by our guest this morning, George Fletcher, professor of law at Columbia University Law School. The book is published by Free Press.